I am joined on the phone by Sarah Lee Guthrie. Sarah, hello. Welcome to the show. Thanks for being here.
Yes.
So this is a pretty big event that's happening coming up here. It's the 50th anniversary of your dad's acclaimed record, Alice's Restaurant Massacre. When did you first realize that your dad was kind of a big deal, so to speak?
You know, that's a really hard question to answer because I think it was gradual, you know, like you said, and it still, I think, grows on me the how much he's influenced people, how, you know, big that world really is. I mean, especially starting with Woody, you know, it's kind of like a growing thing, I think. So, you know, I'm a child. I have no idea what's going on. And then, you know, I went to shows. And of course, you know, you see people's reactions. You see people coming through the door. I always love to, like, be at the merch table and watch people and get people to talk to me. And so I knew he was popular. But that kind of awareness sort of shifts as you get older and you get more keen to what it really means, you know, what who he is to the world. And people that I was surrounded by, you know, Pete Seeger or Ramblin' Jack, you know, they were just people to me that were just hanging around the house. But especially when I started to perform and play music myself, when I started to really get out there, was when I think I really started to understand the significance of not just my family, but my family's friends and my father. And yeah, it's a gradual thing. Seems like it's still dawning on me.
You know, your father, you know, played in a time of much turbulence and sort of much change in the world, and I see a lot of similarities between sort of the world he lived in then and the culture that we are experiencing now. How do you think your father's music and his lyrics from the 60s and 70s relate to what we're seeing and what we're going through here, whether it's, you know, the election or all the activism that we're seeing?
Well, I think that, you know, it's, of course, you know, that was a time where especially during the Woodstock and the war, you know, we really, as a people, needed to stand up and say something. And it was coming to a point, you know. And I think it just kind of, you know, and then things got better. And then, you know, and we felt like that generation really did shift the society and the culture, and things. We rode on that for a long time, and now here we are again, and things are, you know, you kind of look around and you go, really? It's like one of those times where you're like, really? There's people that think like that, and there's, you know, we got to do something about this. And I think the shift is a little bit different, but it's still the same fight, you know. We're still fighting for a more peaceful world and a happier place for our children to grow up in. And there's certain issues that are finally, I think, coming to a point where we can't take it anymore. We're going to have to stand up and say something. And so thank God we have that generation to look up to, you know, because they really showed us how to do it peacefully and how to do it successfully, I think. You know, every little bit counts, and every generation has something to do. And so, yeah, here we are again at the threshold of hopefully another big shift.
Well, you mentioned peace there, which is kind of interesting because we're seeing a lot of the candidates, especially on the GOP side, seem to advocate violence in many respects. Why do you think we have such this dichotomy and this divide that's going on right now?
Well, I take a look around. We've got a very interesting war going on, and it's almost individualized, I think. You know, it's not countries anymore. We're fighting individuals. We're fighting and this is, it's a tough thing to fight. And so I think what I'm saying when I say peace is I'm talking about the peace that my father talks about, really, is the individual peace. It's something that is inside of every single one of us that we could definitely stand to get in touch with a little bit more. Listen, I mean, there's always going to be violence, and there's always going to be peace, and there's going to be love, and there's going to be hate, and there's going to be all these things. But I think right now we're kind of coming into a time where these things are quite extreme, and you're seeing people who are really extremely enlightened and becoming more spiritual and becoming more in tune with our hearts being open and stuff. But you're also seeing the other side of it, which is people who are really, in my perspective, seem to be very disconnected with their peace, and that's, you know, as for the way that I grew up and being a kind of a daughter of people who have always been advocating for peace, you know, we're seeing the need for a more individualized peace, you know, the kind that you greet your neighbor and you do a nice thing here or there. It becomes so overwhelming to try and fight the big wars, the big, you know, countries versus countries. How can one individual do that? And I think what I've sort of settled on, and I think I learned this from my father, is that, you know, the way that we do it is in our communities, and we start at home, and we start within ourselves, and that is the ripple that will eventually sort of ripple out into the rest of the world.
You know, given the type of music that your father sang about and who he was surrounded by, you know, people like Pete Seeger, would you say that politics was ingrained in you from an early age, and sort of the idea that we need to fight for something?
I think we uphold a certain responsibility to show that we care, to be kind, to do the small things that people should do. But politics, I mean, yes, of course, I've learned, you know, from Pete that we get together, we unite, we do have a voice. These are the things that, yes, I absolutely believe in the power of song and the power of music to help these things along, you know. But the politics part of things, you know, and this is why I am such a Bernie Sanders fan, is that I feel as though our politics have become so corrupt by money and corporations and big pharma, and I am really just fighting for the well-being of the human race. And that just seems to go, politics seem to go against everything that I believe in, and that's really hard because you want the system to work. You want it to play by the rules and to be, representative of the way we feel. But I kind of feel, I think, like a lot of people do, where you just go, there's nothing I can do. I'm completely, how can I fight this corruption? And so it's almost gone, like, beyond the rules, beyond what I think we really feel. I look at the news and I'm appalled at who we call our heroes and who we're looking up to in the world of politics. It really just blows my mind. So, yeah, I do feel a very strong belief of fighting that to make it the way I think it's supposed to be, representative of its people.
You mentioned Bernie Sanders, and it's interesting. I mean, we saw him win three states the other day, and they say he's picking up momentum and is leading the popular vote, even though he still trails significantly in delegates. Do you think that indicates perhaps a problem with how the political system is run in the U.S.?
Yeah, but I'm also, you know, I'm also a bit of a an optimist that whether or not Bernie gets into office is not really the point. It would be amazing and it would be great, and the way that he has run his campaign is so inspiring, I think, that allows us to think, wow, maybe we can do it, and even if we can just almost do it. I think it's going to help for the next time around when if it doesn't work, that we know that we can get really close, and so it will work the next time. I'm an optimist in that way. I'm also an optimist to think that he might be our next president because of who we've got going against us. You know, it just doesn't even seem possible. But it's a big country. And there's a lot of different people that think differently. Also, when I'm thinking more big picture, though, you know, like, I mean, we can sit and talk politics, but really when I'm on tour with my father and when I get to talking with him about politics and the way the system is run and, oh, my gosh, where do we fit in? I think that I'm really starting to believe that there's a bigger picture, you know, that it might not matter that much who's in office. I mean, he said it before, and I'll say it, you know, it's like there's one of them, and there's a whole lot of us. So if we want to see changes, we need to, you know, gather in our in the communities and make it happen on a ground level, and that's really how change happens. And so I'm not too worried about all of, you know, what's going on, because I really feel like Bernie is paving a path that we can believe in and follow, whether he's in office or not. And you know, it's giving us a little bit more courage and strength. So these little things, I think, are really inspiring to so many people, and we'll keep it going. We'll keep it happening. The feeling, the beliefs, the ideas that he has brought forth are really just paving, I think, a very new beginning for our country and the world, really.
Well, you know, it's funny because Bernie seems to have a lot of the support of the folk singers of your dad's generation, people like Neil Young and Art Garfunkel. And I'm struck, as we were talking, by, of course, one of the most well-known songs, I've got the whole world in my hands. Why do you think a song like that has resonated for so long and is still relevant at a time like today?
I didn't even know they were using that or referencing that, but I don't know. I guess the U.S. is a very influential country, perhaps. Perhaps we do have the whole world in our hands, and we, as somewhat of a leader in the world, we're, a lot of people are looking. I mean, when I've traveled over into France and I've traveled over into Germany quite a bit and stuff, and especially during election times, you know, people are paying attention. And I think it's really sometimes really interesting to me, because from an outside perspective, it's so much easier to see what's actually going on. You know, for me, when I go overseas and I look back at our country and I go, okay, people are paying attention. And I think that we as Americans should actually start to feel a little bit of that responsibility and maybe perhaps make some better choices.
As we mentioned off the top, it is the 50th anniversary of your dad's Alice Restaurant Massacre. Do you remember the first time you heard that record?
Oh, man. I remember the first time I saw the movie. Dad was horrified. I don't know how I got a hold of it, but I came in, you know, and he came into the room, and here I was watching Alice's Restaurant. You know, there's a point in my personal life that, you know, my friends were listening to The Grateful Dead, and there were, you know, a lot of the Woodstock era was kind of coming back into, you know, people listening to Country Joe and that whole world, and so I kind of took a glance at it myself, and I decided that, well, I'm kind of a more of a Dylan person than a Dead person, but I had to kind of sort of choose, and you know, from then I kind of went into more punk rock, but I always, like, listened to Joan Baez, and I always loved Dylan, and I always actually really respected and loved my father's music and his choice of songs that he sang over the years. And for Alice's Restaurant, it's come up so many times in my life where I have been able to sort of reflect on its significance, and I even tried to learn it at one point in my life. It's funny when your friends are listening to your dad's albums, you know, and you kind of turn around and you go, oh my gosh, really? This is cool. Because for me, I didn't know it was cool. It's hard for someone who, you know, when you're growing up in it, to really know how it affected the world. So, I do remember when it became quite significant in my life. I was just a teenager, you know, in high school.
Given your family lineage and sort of who you were surrounded by growing up, was music the inevitable choice for you, or did you rebel against it at first?
I never thought I would be doing this. I really went the other way. I think I was, you know, I had other sort of aspirations and dreams, and we were always, you know, sort of maybe even discouraged from my dad's perspective. He's like, don't do this. You know, you should become a doctor or a lawyer or do something real. But I kind of think that might have been a scheme or even a plan of his that he didn't want to push us into it. You know, he didn't want us to think that it was expected of us, and so that perhaps we might come around to it on our own, which is exactly what happened. You know, I didn't think I would be doing this. My life was sort of sideswiped, and I was on one path, and then all of a sudden I met my husband, who I've been working with for the last 15 years, and made lots of records, Johnny Irian, and I met him out in Los Angeles in 97, and he taught me a few chords on the guitar, and I was already kind of on a path of writing. I had always written, and so he kind of took a look at my writings and said, you have songs here, and I went, what? I do, and he said, just put this chord progression to it, check it out, try it, and I did, and I fell in love. It was really, my life seemed to just take shape at that point, and my dad asked me on the road, and I spent the next 6 years on the road with my dad, playing, learning. Essentially, that was my college, that was my university, was being on the road with dad, and here I am, I guess, almost 20 years, can I say that? I can. Almost 20 years into it, and I now, I'm really grateful. This is a really good time, I think, to be a folk singer. I'm finally proud to say that. You know, it took me a while to come around to that even, you know. But especially now, and celebrating the 50th anniversary of Alice's Restaurant, and being with my father, you know, my mom passed away about almost 4 years ago. I don't know how much more time we have together. And so my life seems to be very significant in the way that I get to spend this great time with my dad. I get to live in a time where I think we need folk singers. And I get to bring forth amazing songs that I grew up with and I love. And it's just like I feel as though, I'm really grateful that I made the choice to follow in these footsteps. I'm just a very small link in what has become an amazing chain of singers and good people in this world. And I feel like I'm really grateful to be a part of that push.
You mentioned performing with your husband, and I'm curious as to what that experience is like for you, and if you can see any parallels between that and when you perform with your father.
I feel like it's totally different. I mean, yes, I'm performing with two people that I love very, very much, but my time with my husband and performing with him, I guess the similarities might be that I'm really, it's family. This is a lifestyle for us. It's not like we make a record and, you know, a big company puts it out and we're like, you know, trying to chart or anything like that. This kind of music and this kind of thing that we do, it's lifestyle. It's with people that we love, for people that we love. It's will always be here. It seems like I think a little bit more everlasting than perhaps, you know, if we were making music that was for radio play. This kind of thing with my husband that we created, you know, we made kids records with our children, so he was working with our children, and then we brought it together with the whole Guthrie family, my sisters, my brother, who's been playing on the road with my dad for almost 40 years, I think, or in the 30, I'm giving him too many years, since he was very, very young, and that's the kind of, I mean, that's pure love. When you get that many people together, family, that with a bigger family, meaning audience, when you walk away from it, they really feel the generations of music, and that's pretty powerful.
So finally, you know, we're it's going to be a big 50th anniversary. I know you're going to be there with your dad. What can fans of your father look forward to at this event?
Well, I'll tell you, he's not going to talk politics. So if you're a Trump supporter, don't worry, you can still come. I am always in awe of my father's shows. I feel like he creates an atmosphere that is for everyone, and it is. He's a master storyteller. That's one of my favorite parts of his shows, is that you really get a sense that you were one big family, and the stories are so entertaining, and you will laugh and you will cry. It's a sentimental show, actually. I mean, we do a beautiful tribute to my mother, and she was such a matriarch of our family, and but you also get a little bit of Woody spirit as well, and you kind of, I think you're going to come away what we do, it's not just entertaining. I really feel it as if it's healing, and it's a great experience. I'm having a great time out on the road with him. The shows are amazing. I mean, he was always a great performer, but I think this show particularly, with its multimedia effects and everything that's going on, is really, really, it's fun, but it's also really great. You know, it's a very fulfilling show.
Well, the show is the 50th anniversary concert special of Alice's Restaurant, Arlo Guthrie, featuring Sarah Lee Guthrie, among others. Sarah Lee, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
We'll see you in Vancouver.
Yes, I love Vancouver. I very much look forward to that.
Alrighty, take care.
Thank you. You too.
Vince Dittrich, hello, welcome to the show. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So, it's a bit of an end of an era in Canadian music. You guys, Spirit of the West, are playing a couple of final shows in Vancouver at the end of the month here. I suppose that John's health had something to do with this decision, but
When did you guys decide that now, what was the time to wrap this up?
I think we slowly evolved to that decision over the last year. Because, yes, the trigger is John's Alzheimer's. There's some other health issues, too, but happily they're ones that can be medically adjusted, contained, fixed. But they are very serious.
What was it like for you guys as a group when John first came to you and told you guys that he had these health problems?
Well, it was, because we're such a close-knit family, we knew that there was something not quite right, but we weren't sure what it was. And this dates back some time. But once the diagnosis happened, and that took a long time to come down, because obviously a doctor doesn't want to just glibly throw out the possibility of Alzheimer's without absolutely being sure. So once he actually said, it's official, this is the diagnosis, we had some mental preparation coming up to it. Not a lot, though. It was still a very shocking thing, and I was overcome with dread for the first couple of days, that's for sure.
You know, it seems like in the last few years, you know, even before John's health, you know, you've become a manager. You've become somewhat of a leader in the band. How has being in that position maybe helped you get through this?
Well, that's an interesting question. No one's asked me that before, but it's spot on. I'm required to take whatever's thrown at me and digest it into little parcels for everybody else to swallow. And the process of doing that allows me to get my head around it, you know, be it good news or bad news.
And I mean, given the fact that you guys were so close, that you know you'd already had that bond because you had been together for so long, I guess, did that make it easier for you guys to grieve collectively, or whatever term you want to use?
Well, I guess you could call it grieving, and if indeed it is grieving, it began a while ago, and it's going to keep on going for a long, long time. Because not only do we lose, you know, this part of our career, you know, the performance part of our career, but we lose connection with our brother. You know, it's a very profound loss.
What do you think Spirit of the West and to a certain extent John Mann has meant to the music community, not only here in Vancouver, but also across Canada?
Well, I don't know if I'm in the position to actually see us from outside of ourselves, but I'm told that we've gone from being a bunch of sweaty upstarts to... they call us a legendary band. So if we're legendary, then I guess we've done something worthy of legend. But what I can say is that we have worked every single show without lying to you or pumping this up. We have never gone on stage and phoned it in. Never once. We worked our asses off. And we didn't use pyrotechnics or fancy light shows. We just worked. And we tried to use the maximum amount of communication and charm, skill, just all the things that you learn through decades and decades of doing this. We try to apply it all every night to the greatest level of excellence that we could manage. And some nights were hard because we were exhausted or tired or sick or out of practice or, you know, so many factors. But it's been an honor. It's been a real honor to do this.
You mentioned just before we started here that, you know, you've got your grandkids with you. You're busy being a human being outside of the music. And I'm curious, like, you know, since having kids and now grandkids and having that outside life, how has that affected you creatively, and has it brought a sense of balance to your life?
Well, luckily, in the Spirit of the West, we're a family of musicians who always put family first. which has been a blessing and a curse. Certainly, we could have pushed harder and harder and harder and done all sorts of career things that went further than what we achieved, but we were never willing to chase fame at the risk of our families. We just wouldn't do it. And so we have these amazing families who've stuck with us through thick and thin, and I'm happy to announce that I'm the first grandfather in the band, and I have my little grandson Oliver in my arms as I speak to you, and he's dead asleep happily because he was a little vocal a few minutes ago. And it's just always been about family, you know. For example, my younger son, his middle name is Jeffrey, after Jeffrey Kelly, and you know, there are other names named after band members. It's just such a tight-knit little community.
You mentioned a little bit earlier about, you know, pyrotechnics and all sort of some of the bigger aspects that come with performance. Now you guys have managed to stay smaller, and I wanted to get your thoughts about how you've seen music evolve over the last couple of decades, you know, since you guys first started out, and what do you think your thoughts on that are?
Well, I have many opinions, but some of them might really jar. But I think overall, my sense as a musicologist, I see digital technology allowing people to just lift tones and samples, all phrases from older stuff. They've used what was being done in the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s to about 1995 or so as a mine, and they've been mining parts from it and recombining it. And it becomes less performance and more mosaic, audio mosaic, which is completely legitimate and very interesting, but it definitely changes the tenor of everything because these songs oftentimes are being generated by the software, and you grow to love them as you build them in the form of software and waveforms. So it's not the same as a bunch of people sitting around with guitars and maybe a drum or a tambourine and making a song from scratch. It's a different animal. It's equally valid. It's just different.
But I also know that at least in recent years, technology has helped out you guys in your performances. John's been using, is it some sort of iPad when he's performing?
Oh, yeah. As far as that's concerned, of course, we always embrace technology to make things easier and faster and smoother. John does have to use the iPad as a teleprompter, which is wonderful because, you know, a few years ago, we wouldn't have been able to use something like that. We literally would have had to have a teleprompter, which is a big piece of equipment, and it's unwieldy and complicated. And, you know, just to have an iPad with triggered by a foot pedal for page turns is a minor miracle, but it's really helped us.
So you guys are playing your final two shows at the Commodore, which seems only fitting, such a legendary venue for such a legendary band.
It's actually our final three shows.
Final 14, three shows.
15, 16.
Excuse me. What does the Commodore mean to you? Not only you guys as a band, but what do you think it's meant to the Vancouver music scene as a whole?
Oh, I think that for live musicians, when people think of Vancouver, they think of the Commodore, you know. It's just sort of it's the pulse of Vancouver. Everybody's played there, for heaven's sakes. You know, a few of them become so popular that they can fill up hockey rinks and what have you, but for the most part, people end up at the Commodore. It's a beautiful place to dance and have a drink, and the sight lines are tremendous, and it sounds good, and the house crew there is par excellence, better than anywhere else, and for us, it's home ice.
When you guys walk off the stage that final time on the 16th, how emotional do you think it's going to be for you all?
Oh, God, I'm just about breaking up just thinking about it, so I mean, really, as I said, you know, let me put it to you this way. Everyone in the band has spent more than half their life in the band. So when that goes away, it is a major, major component of our life. We're watching the door close on a major component of our lives.
Are you going to? It's going to be difficult, but are you going to enjoy being a spectator in all the great music that Vancouver has to offer?
Oh, sure. I always enjoy that. And I find that when I don't have to participate in it, I can enjoy it more because I worry about nuts and bolts and all those other things. When you're actually playing, you worry about so much detail and the aggravation of travel and all those things. If you can just listen to a great band, that's one of the great pleasures in life, isn't it?
Who are maybe some up-and-coming bands that you have your eye on right now or that you would encourage people to perhaps check out?
Well, I think there are probably a bunch, and one group that I'm actually very interested in right now is a Victoria-based group called Carmana. They've got something there.
Yes.
And I'm also very, very delighted with Jesse Roper. He's not only a very talented man, but he is a tremendous gentleman.
What do you want, or how do you want people to remember Spirit of the West? What would you want your legacy to be, so to speak?
I hope you'll remember us as really solid guys who did the country proud.
Well, you definitely did. Vince Dietrich, thank you so much for taking the time out today. I know it's been a bit emotional this last little while, but I appreciate it.
Yeah, it was nice speaking with you, and thank you very much.
Alrighty, have a good day. Cheers.
Okay, bye-bye.
I am pleased to be joined on the phone by the co-founder of Occupy Wall Street, Micah White. Micah, hello, welcome to the show. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Dan. It's an awesome opportunity. Thank you.
So your book is The End of Protest, A New Playbook for Revolution. And I guess the first thing, it's a little bit curious, you know, as someone who co-founded one of the most well-known protests in recent memory, you're titling your book The End of Protest. Why did Occupy for you sort of signal the end of that specific type of movement?
Yeah, that's a really excellent question, and it's a good place to start. I think that, you know, among the activist community, there's a kind of tendency to see everything as a success. You know, nothing ever fails, and I think that narrative feels really good, but it stops us from learning from our failures. And I think that Occupy Wall Street, it was basically a constructive failure because we created the ideal social movement. We created the social movement that everyone had been, you know, the model of the social movement everyone thought would somehow create social change, which is to get millions of people into the streets. And, you know, we had 82 different countries, 1,000 encampments rallying around largely the same demand, largely nonviolent. And it did not achieve the social change that we set out to achieve, you know? And so that's why it's important to understand that it's a constructive failure, because in failing, it taught us that paradigm we've been chasing, that storyline we've been chasing, isn't true. We need to become more sophisticated as activists about how we think about achieving social change.
Well, it's interesting you mention that, because I know, you know, in the time that it happened, a lot of the, you know, the pundits, the analysts, and the media were like, I don't know what these guys stand for, because every protest was something different. Was that part of the constructed failure aspect of it, was to let each individual group decide for themselves what they wanted to be about?
Well, you know, I mean, I think personally, I don't think that that's really where the failure point comes in, because if you go back to another good example to kind of counterpose to that, would be the February 15th, 2003 Global Anti-War March. And if anyone was alive back then and remembers that, basically it was this amazing event where people in every single country protested against the impending Iraq war. And it still happened. The war still happened. and the month after. And so in that case, if you Google, you know, February 15, 2003 anti-war march, you'll see that there's these pictures of millions of people in the streets all carrying the exact same sign that just says no to the war. And so it was very obvious what everyone wanted in the streets, but it also didn't achieve the social change. So I think that it's not about having a specific demand or not having demand. It's about this deeper question, which is that protesters act as if you can just gain sovereignty by getting a lot of people into the streets. That's basically what we're acting as. We're acting as if, oh yeah, I got a million people into the streets. That means that somehow I have sovereignty and I can like dictate the course of society. But that's not true. You know, getting a million people into the streets does not give you some sort of sovereignty over your government.
You know, in the book, you mention a lot about timing, about how Occupy happened at the right time, you know, shortly after what happened in Tunisia and the Arab Spring in the Middle East. Why, for you, do you think it worked out this time, timing-wise?
You know, that is, I think, it's also a really good question, because the thing about revolution is that, first of all, we know that they're one of these complex, recurring phenomena in human society. We know that revolutions have been happening for thousands of years. We actually have a record of a revolution in ancient Egypt, like 5,000 years ago. So we know that periodically, humans rise up, they go into these mass social movements, they overthrow governments. But at the same time, we also know that revolutions come as a surprise. Like the Russian Revolution, if you read Trotsky's History of the Russian Revolution, he talks about how it surprised everyone. And the same thing with Occupy. It came as a complete surprise. And so you have this paradox between the revolution, you know it's going to happen eventually, but also it always comes as a surprise. And so with Occupy Wall Street, yeah, we basically, I think we hit that perfect moment where people were so hungry to import the revolutionary wave that was happening in Egypt and Spain. They so desperately wanted to bring it to America. And what Adbusters and I did is we gave people a new tactic that allowed that movement to spread to America. So, in brief, a social movement is created. First, you have to have a willing historical moment. Then you have to have some sort of contagious mood that spreads throughout the people. And then you need a new tactic that inspires the people and makes them believe that this is going to fundamentally change society.
And how do you think it's changed, you know, politics and discourse, especially in the U.S. where it was most heavy? Because we're sort of seeing the two sides. Now, you've got Bernie Sanders, the revolutionary, on one side, and then you've got Trump on the other, and a lot of people are calling them, like, you know, the two sides of the coin. How do you see Occupy playing into the current presidential race?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's definitely, that's why, you know, I don't say Occupy is a total failure. Obviously, it fundamentally changed the discourse and the culture in America. I mean, it had a profound impact on, you know, we talk about income inequality now in a way that we didn't ever talk about before. We talk about the 1%, the 99%, all of these things. But again, I think it's very important for activists to realize that those are symptoms of the fact that we created a movement that spread to 82 countries. If any time that you create a social movement that reaches the stature of Occupy Wall Street, involving millions of people all over the world, anytime you do that, which is extremely rare, but anytime you do that, it's going to have these cultural reverberations, these cultural consequences. It's going to introduce new concepts, new languages, new forms of art and music into society. But you can't celebrate those symptoms as success. Those are byproducts. Those aren't the signatures of our success. And so it's kind of hard to grasp, but once you understand that, you see, oh, okay, like I can't orient around trying to raise awareness, which is what a lot of activists think, but instead raising awareness is a byproduct of creating a movement that spreads successfully to so many countries.
Well, what's interesting is that, you know, we had all the stuff going on in North America and, you know, Vancouver, New York, Toronto, and all over Europe and the Middle East too, where there was a lot of successes. And then you had the civil war in Syria, which didn't seem to have the same result as other countries where there was overthrows of dictators. Do you have a theory as to why that happened?
Well, that's a really complex question, because I think on the one hand, you know, if we want to get a little bit more sophisticated about how we think about social movements and what social movements are, on the one hand, you know, there's this thing that I kind of call social movement warfare, which is the idea that social movements are actually being used by governments as a better and more ideal form of war. Because if you think about it, you can't just like can't just, like, if you want Mubarak to step down, which the U.S. government did want Mubarak to step down prior to the Egyptian Revolution, you can't just go in there and invade anymore. You have to use, first you stimulate protests, and then you use those protests and you say, look, your people are protesting, like, you need to step down. And so in Egypt, that's what we saw, which is that these secular youth were basically, you know, the Western government was able to point them and say, look, you have people in the streets protesting Mubarak, you need to step down, we're going to pull your military funding and let you step down, all that kind of stuff. But then I think, and I think then when it goes to Libya and Syria, it became murkier, and they started to actually think that they could just, you know, go straight from street protests, and that if the person didn't step down, well, we'll just go in and invade, and we've seen how that's been, like, so disastrous. But I think what I'm trying to say here is that social movements can be used by Western powers against other states, but when those exact same social movements, behaviors, and protests happen in Western states, there's no force that forces them to listen. There's no one that said to Obama, hey, you need to listen to Occupy Wall Street. You know, there's no force that says that. So that's one of the reasons why protests can seem to be effective abroad, but then not effective at home.
The term social movement is an interesting one, and it seems to be probably a little more PC, perhaps, than protest. How would you sort of break down and describe at its heart the term behind social movement?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I think that, so if you start with the word protest, the origin of the word protest is basically this idea that it's like you're seeking legal redress, you're seeking recognition from the court that you have a case, you know, if you actually go back to the origins of the word protest. So it's basically like a behavior that you do to get the attention of the people in power so that they recognize, yes, you have a legal case and I will listen to your case. But I think now protest has become, if you think about the meaning of protest, today protest is any sort of collective behavior that the people do that they believe is going to create social change. And that's why some protests, you know, it doesn't seem like they would create social change, but if the participants believe that it will, it's somehow recognized as protest, and it, like, functions as protest. But and for social movements, I think a social movement is basically, it's kind of like it's basically the contagious mood combined with these new behaviors. That's what essentially a social movement is. And so you combine, like, the Arab Spring and Occupy, I think the mood was one of kind of fearlessness, losing your fear. And then it was coupled onto this new tactic of gathering in the financial districts and holding these general assemblies. So social movements seem to be this kind of mass phenomenon where people suddenly are inspired with a new kind of spirit, but at the same time start to adopt these new social behaviors together.
I think the sort of the last time we saw a mass global movement was during the communist era. And, you know, in today's society, communist sort of has a negative connotation. But do you see any similarities about sort of those movements in the 50s, 60s, and 70s and what we're seeing today all across Europe?
Well, I do think that like I said, I feel like from one perspective, protesters today are part of a 5,000-year story. Like, they're part of it. There's been protests for since the dawn of inegalitarian society, and the people have basically been trying to develop these behaviors, these social behaviors, in order to collectively liberate ourselves from inegalitarian society. So we're part of a storyline that goes not just back to the 20th century, but all the way back to, like, you know, 2000 BC. But I do also think that what we're seeing now is a return to some of those leftist dreams that I think people gave up on in the 80s, 90s, and beyond, when they started to see what happened is that basically people lost hope in the possibility of revolution, and they also lost hope in the desirability of revolution, because they started to see that, well, you know, like, anyone who looked at what was going on in Russia with Stalin and what happened in Mao in China, like, they became disillusioned. Maybe revolution isn't something that is good. Maybe it's something that we don't want. And they kind of gave up on that universal project of human liberation that has been so underpinning the left since the French Revolution. But I think we're seeing a return to that. I think that might be the kind of similarities that you're seeing, which is that we are seeing a return to this kind of dream of, like, maybe we can create a global social movement that liberates all people everywhere and, like, maybe we can do these things that the that Marx and Lenin believed were possible. And so I think it's kind of beautiful.
And that also, you know, I think, especially in today, you know, with Sanders running, another term that we hear thrown on is socialist and socialism, and how negative that is. But do you see a clear separation between social movement and the ideas of socialism?
Yeah, you know, I do. I mean, I think for me, I like to say that I'm entering into like a post-ideological stage. You know, I think that one of the problems with the left, generally speaking, is that it's so rationally oriented that it one of the kind of assumptions of the left is that what we really need to do is come up with a proper political ideology and platform, and then everyone's going to kind of rally and join us and all this kind of thing. But, you know, I think that actually social movements, like I said, are motivated out of the mood, out of the what it feels like to be part of the movement. That's why people really join them. And that's why you can get into the paradoxical situation where people are like, we don't even understand what occupiers are protesting. I ask them and they all protesting something different. It's like, yeah, because it's not about the specific idea of or policy. It's about the mood. And so that's why I'm feeling like a little bit jaded on this idea that we all need to like adopt some sort of, you know, are you an anti-capitalist? Are you a socialist? Like, you need to, you know, define yourself. Otherwise, we're not going to, like, you know, be on your side. I think it's more about creating movements that people believe are going to win, and also that, you know, that makes them feel like they're losing their fear.
And I know a lot of this started online. I know you sent your first tweet when Twitter was still relatively new. How do you think, social media, Twitter, Facebook, and the advancement of technology in general has perhaps helped fuel the revolutionary spirit, if you want to call it that?
Yeah. I think revolutionary spirit is a good term. I mean, you know, the internet, like I said, the social movements need a contagious mood and a new tactic. Well, the internet is perfect for that, because the internet allows us, like, if you go back and you look at the Arab Spring, I remember I was like watching in live stream what was happening in Tahrir Square. I mean, and then there was millions of people all over the world who were watching live footage of these protesters in Egypt as they toppled Mubarak. And so that allowed a kind of simultaneous, global, contagious, revolutionary mood to spread, you know? And at the same time, when we came up with the idea of Black Bear Wall Street, and we sent out this tactical briefing basically telling people, let's combine what's going on in Spain with what's happening in Egypt, bring it to America. We were able, you know, within 24 hours of sending out that email, it got taken up by activists on the East Coast in New York who started organizing. So the internet has this tremendous ability for spreading contagious moods, spreading new tactics, which is so fundamental to creating social movements. But of course, the internet is also a double-edged sword. You know, it's also something that destroys our revolutionary intuition if we rely on metrics too much, and it also can damage movements in the later stages, because it starts to look better online than in real life. So people start to hang out on Facebook rather than going into the streets, and so there's a kind of, you know, it's a weapon that social movements need to use, but they need to also use in a kind of very sophisticated way.
And how do you think the media plays into all this? Because they had, you know, covered it for months, weeks, days on end, and then they seem to have just lost interest in the whole thing. Where do you think the media's role comes in terms of talking about the revolutions that are happening?
Yeah, I think that's a really perceptive observation about how the media functions. I think that a lot of activists have this naive view that the media is necessarily against. Basically, they naively think that it's a victory when the media starts to talk about your movement. I think that is not necessarily the case. I think in some countries, like in Brazil, you know, when they had their social movement in 2013, yeah, the media assumed a very negative posture about the protests from the get-go, and were like, we don't like these, and they're bad, and all this kind of stuff. But actually, I think that if you go on The Guardian, you know, the UK's Guardian website, they're constantly celebrating protests in America. They're constantly pumping up the protests. And so there's actually this other thing that happens, which is that the Western media likes to celebrate ineffective protest. And the moment it starts to get a little bit too edgy, a little bit too revolutionary, they switch gears and they start to attack it, which is what I think would happen with Occupy Wall Street. And so a lot of activists fall into this trap. Like, even today, you'll see people who are, they're complaining. They're like, why isn't CNN reporting on the Democracy Spring protest? Which, of course, these protests are a complete farce. But why aren't they protest? Why aren't they covering the protest? And they don't understand they're falling into a trap, which is that we start to look into the media as a mirror of our movement, and then that allows the media to really control how we see our movement. It allows the media to, if we're looking for the media to reflect back to us what our movement is, well, then of course the media has this tremendous ability to kind of control and destroy the movement. But they control and destroy the movement, like you observed, not by attacking it from the get-go, but pretending to be on your side. And I think you can see that very clearly with Occupy Wall Street. A lot of media, at first they ignored it, of course, but then once they talked about it, they were all about it. They thought it was so exciting. And then it was like synchronized. It was like, okay, now we're against this thing that we previously kind of celebrated. And like, let's talk about how there's so much dirt and disease and all this kind of stuff. So.
Well, what I found was interesting is that, you know, I think Occupy Wall Street was looked at more positively perhaps from media sources outside of the United States, and that the United States media had sort of a more negative or at least lukewarm perception towards it. What was it like for you observing how perhaps other people from other countries talked about what you did versus those in your own?
I don't know. I mean, that's a tough question. I think the media that I was so interested in was this like development of the live stream culture. You know, there was this time during Occupy Wall Street when you could like just tune into these citizen live streamers who would like carry around their cell phones, and you could just like jump right into the middle of the crowd and all this kind of stuff. But you know, I think that the world so desperately wants a revolution in America, because a revolution in America would be the center, you know, is the center of the financial dictatorship and would be tremendously beneficial to the rest of the world. So of course there's a lot of external media that wants to pump it up. I mean, I think one case that's really interesting to think about is RT, Russia Television, and how they went so far to encourage Occupy that they started to like basically what I would consider lies. Like, not, I mean, they would take the truth and they would exaggerate it very significantly in order to kind of like, you know, pump up occupiers and like convince them that, you know, everything, you know, whatever. So I think that, because of course that benefits Russia's political agenda, which is so we see again this tension between how protests, revolutions always need the help of external forces. I mean, even the Russian Revolution, Lenin needed the help of Germany, which was at war with Russia at the time, to get back to Russia from his exile. That Germany was the only country that would help facilitate bringing him back into Russia to lead the revolution. And Germany did that because they knew that Lenin would end the war with Germany. And so the same thing happens. As Occupy Wall Street happens, and the Russians start to think, well, maybe we should pump up this movement because it could really help us achieve our political aims. And so I think as an activist, it's about being more sophisticated and just being aware that that's real, and then seeing about, well, how can we like use this to our advantage?
And finally, we're talking about, you know, activism and social media and protests, and it seems like the one sort of buzz theme, I guess, of right now is intersectionality, you know, where you're talking about intersectional feminism or, you know, intersectional rights. How do you think going forward that will help us come to a more wholesome revolution, if at all?
Well, I think that, I mean, from a philosophical perspective, I think that part of the like kind of postmodern or post-structuralist project that has been going on for a couple decades now has been this blurring of binaries and the breaking down of borders and all this kind of stuff. So it seems to me that that's kind of like, you know, it's part of the like intellectual zeitgeist at the moment, you know, this kind of like breaking down of things. But I guess, I mean, more broadly speaking, I guess for me, there is this, you know, I'm a globalist. I believe that there's going to be a global social movement that's going to somehow unite the world into one world, and that we're not going to have borders anymore. We're not going to have passports and visas and all this kind of stuff that keeps us divided. So I guess that's how I would kind of respond.
Well, the book is The End of Protest, a new playbook for revolution. Michael White, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you. It was an absolute pleasure. Thanks, Dan.
Alrighty, cheers.